pro-nuclear and two anti-nuclear lawyers. The pro-nuclear lawyers were to be me, because I was chairman of the lawyers committee of the AIF, and Mark Rowden, who was a lawyer then in private practice, but formerly a chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and before that the general counsel of the old Atomic Energy Commission. The anti-nuclear lawyers were two very prominent lawyers who had represented groups like the Sierra Club and other major organizations. The hearing was scheduled for a Monday, and the committee of the Congress had 19 members. Typically, this was a full committee hearing. Typically, in a hearing like that, you would have one member from each party there, and maybe one or two other members would drop in so that their words could be recorded for home use. That would be it. And the questioning would be done by the staff. So the hearing is scheduled on a Wednesday, and the prior Friday night, Chernobyl occurred. And that changed the nature of the hearing. I got a call. Actually, I got a call on Friday night.
And this the year was?
This is 1986.
Okay, and when was Three Mile Island?
Three Mile Island had occurred in 1979, in March 1979, March 30, 1979 or 29. But this is now 6-7 years later, and I get a call, and they said, we think you need to come up to speed on the Russian system of licensing and the contrast between their system and our system, and we will have experts from the industry, and we are scouting around in various places. We will also have people from the government, from the Department of Energy, who know a lot about this, to brief you. Instead of coming down on Tuesday afternoon, can you come down first thing Monday morning, or better yet, Sunday night to Washington, and spend the time being briefed? And we were briefed on what happened at Chernobyl, what the Russian system was, what the reactor was like at Chernobyl, why it was different from our reactors, why we had rejected that technology, the openness and so forth. There were actually people in the United States, it isn't generally known, there were people in the United States working in the United States who had been engineers in the Soviet Union who had worked on the design of the Chernobyl reactor. And we got briefed by one of them on the design, more than I ever wanted to know about the design of the Soviet reactors. And so we went into this hearing, and instead of having two congressmen, 18 of the 19 committee members were there. CNN was there, live television, C-SPAN was there, the New York Times and the Washington Post. I mean, this was the first hearing on a nuclear subject after Chernobyl. And we had changed our testimony so that we were going to testify as to why what happened in the Soviet Union couldn't happen in the United States because of our open system, our democratic open system of licensing. And why we had rejected some 20 years earlier the technology that the Russians had there, and how our wonderful democratic system, and we were waving the American flag and motherhood and apple pie. And the congressman, of course, also wanted to reassure the American public that Chernobyl couldn't happen in the United States. And so they picked up on this theme of our direct testimony. And they asked us all the softball questions. And they did it in the form of they'd give a little speech and then would say, don't you agree? I mean, we didn't have to testify at all. They would give a speech waving how great our system is, and the intervener lawyers, of course, who were there to criticize our system, were being given the tough time. The anti-nuclear lawyers were given the tough time. It was the most unique hearing I've ever been in.
And not so unusual.
Huh?
And not so unusual.
Not so unusual. I've never seen a hearing before or since that was quite like that hearing. It was a wonderful experience to do that. We were interviewed by the press and so forth. And of course, the person who was with me, Mark Rowden, was the former chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So that carried a lot of a lot of weight, and I was speaking on behalf of the Industries and Trade Association, and that carried some weight, whatever weight that was worth. And it was a very interesting experience. I remember also when Three Mile Island occurred. The reason I remember that so well is Westinghouse had sent a group over to Japan on a sales trip to sell reactors to Japan. One of them was a fellow named Bill Lester. And I got a call. I was at home, and I got a call, and the operator comes on, and you know, it's very hard for people who speak, for whom Japanese is their native language, to pronounce L's. They pronounce them as R's, just because of the way the palate works. And I get a call, it's a long distance operator, Mr. William Rester, and I didn't know who it was, is, can you hold for him? And Bill Lester gets on the phone and he said, tell me everything you know about Three Mile Island. And Three Mile Island had occurred a couple days earlier while he was traveling over there, and I was pretty much up to speed on it. And so I was able to tell him what I knew, which he needed in order to go into his meeting over there. So I remember when both of those events occurred. It's been a very interesting period dealing with the nuclear industry.
And now it's almost
going to
be non-existent?
In the United States today, we have about 110 reactors that are operating. They provided last year's a little over 20% of all the electricity in this country. It's very uneven. In New England states, they provide over half of the electricity. In Chicago, they provide over half of the electricity. Some places, they provide none. Those plants have another useful life of 10 or 20 years, some of them. They could probably be renewed. Some of them will be for another 20, 30 years, maybe. But we are not building any plants in the United States. We haven't had any new orders since 1978, and all the orders after 73 were canceled. So we haven't, or after 74 were canceled, so we haven't really had any new plants. So a few new ones have come online since then, because they take a long time to build. So most of the nuclear work in the United States is providing nuclear fuel and providing nuclear services and updating of plants and so forth. In the rest of the world, the situation isn't quite the same. France has a major nuclear program. About 80% of all the French electricity comes from nuclear power. And the French are continuing to build reactors of a Westinghouse design, I might add. The former Soviet Union and some of the countries that were part of the former Soviet Empire are still have plans to build reactors. One reason that after Chernobyl, there are a whole bunch of plants at Chernobyl. None of the Chernobyl-type reactors are operating, but the Russians had other type of reactors operating. Some of them are operating at Chernobyl despite an intense effort to shut them down. And the reason is they supply 40% of all the electricity to Ukraine. And so you can't pull out 40% of your electricity unless you have an alternative source. They don't have an alternative source. Japan has ordered reactors within the last year or two. Taiwan has ordered reactors within the last year or two. Korea has ordered reactors within the last several years.
Because cost efficient for those countries?
And because they don't have natural resources to build other types of plants. They don't have, in Japan, they don't have coal, they don't have oil, they don't have gas, natural gas. So nuclear power is efficient. The Chinese have the biggest projected nuclear program. They have been ordering plants every year now recently. The U.S. hasn't been able to sell there because of certain restrictive laws which are due to come off here in the next month or two. The Chinese will probably build 50 nuclear reactors in the next 10 years. And they probably need to build 50 every 10 years for the next 50 years. They're so short of power. And so there are technologies for advanced plants, safer plants, that are being worked on. One of the major things I'm working on with Westinghouse right now is the certification of the design of an advanced passive nuclear reactor, which is the next generation of nuclear plants. They're safer, cheaper, and they're simplified compared with the present plants. If we get the design certified, and we're coming pretty close, the Chinese have indicated they're interested in building.
Will Westinghouse still be a dominant factor in that business?
It's hard to say. As you probably,
will there be
you
Westinghouse?
You probably read the series last week on who killed Westinghouse. The Westinghouse technology is still first rate. And Westinghouse, despite everything that's happened and all the cutbacks in personnel, still has some very, very capable engineers. Their advanced plant is the most advanced plant being worked on in the world. I would expect, Yogi Berra once said, predictions are hard to make, especially about the future, but I would expect that that Westinghouse will sell both its nuclear divisions and the other two divisions that it has to someone who will keep and maintain that operation. And if they put the investment into it, then there will be, it'll be a different name. They'll still have the Westinghouse name. Westinghouse name has a big, a lot of meaning elsewhere. But they will pull the, they will sell those plants. It'll be a different company selling Westinghouse reactors. And a lot of those jobs, I think, will stay in Pittsburgh.
That's nice to hear. Do you, from working with them so closely all these years, really feel very confident in the safety
of the nuclear plants?
Uh-huh.
Yes, I think that what Three Mile Island demonstrated was how safe the plants really are. In Three Mile Island, the operators made a series of mistakes. Some people think 17 or 18 consecutive mistakes. But they made a series of mistakes attempting to override the safety systems in the plant because they thought, and what they thought they saw happening, needed those systems to be overridden. They didn't really understand what was happening. Despite that, the plant defeated the operator's best attempts to defeat the plant, and it shut down automatically. And the newer plants are have more systems that do that. So I think the probability of a significant accident leading to a significant off-site release of radioactivity is minuscule.
Do we have to worry about the former Soviet Union?
Well, yeah, I think we do. We are trying to upgrade some of their reactors, some of their control systems, and so forth. We don't have to worry about Chernobyl-type plants as they get shut down. If they were still running Chernobyl-type plants, I'd be worried. Although in the Chernobyl plant accident, they actually had a system that nobody else would adopt, and they shut off the safety systems while they ran some experiments on the plant. That's what caused the problem. But they would, but the Russians, the newer Russian reactors in the new generation are have a lot of the technology that that we have. And the Russians actually don't sell very much outside of the former Soviet Union. And with safer technology, you're going to see, I think those plants can be made to be safe. I still am a little nervous because one of the things that makes plants safe is the safety culture at the plant, the culture of the individuals working at the plant. And that's something that our country and Britain and France and Germany and Japan have just driven into the people. I don't know whether the Russian safety culture is as good. And safety culture is very important. Thinking safety first, second, and last is the most important thing for these plants.
the last thing I wanted to ask you today before we conclude with you spent a lot of time today on your work in the nuclear field,
right.
And obviously with Westinghouse as well. Since the Pittsburgh Press, Post-Gazette just had the series of articles about Westinghouse over the years and the different presidents and their culture, is there anything that you could add or enlighten? Those were somewhat general feelings, and those who knew Westinghouse.
The press had a six-part series. I think it was five or six-part series. Beginning with last week, Don Burnham, who was president in the 60s, and going through each of the presidents since then, and what happened to cause the demise of Westinghouse. The series were somewhat general. I thought they were remarkably accurate as to what was going on. From the perspective of the nuclear divisions, what's happened in the last few years is that they have been cut back. They've lost a lot of the R&D that used to be behind the Westinghouse technology, and I think that it's too bad that that's occurred. But I don't think it's been cut so badly that when they get a new buyer with a new outlook and really wants to make a go of it, that they can't be successful. And General Electric, for example, has proved that you can make money in the nuclear business. ABB Brown Bavaria have proved that you can make money in the nuclear business. And I'm not so sure that the Westinghouse nuclear divisions don't make money. I think they do. Maybe not as much as the management would like to see, but I think they do. Having lived a lot of it, I saw some of the errors that were going on. And I don't mean to say that I saw them in advance, but I watched as they developed. It's really too bad because the company overall is very strong technologically. Somewhere it got lost.
Can you provide any other additional insight so that, you know, as a Monday morning quarterback?
Well, it struck me that the uranium cases, with which I was very familiar, were the result of Westinghouse taking some risks that they didn't really understand. Unbearing from the uranium cases proved to be a major time consumer for the management of the company. And that was one example of not really thinking through at the top. The major problem that I think I saw, and it was mentioned a couple times in the article, is that there was too much emphasis, especially over the last 20 years, on short-term, quarter-to-quarter profits at the expense of long-term development. Westinghouse had one of the great research centers in the world sitting out in Churchill. At one time they had, I don't know, 50 or 60 patent lawyers. And the patent lawyers were all separate from the law department. They now have maybe, three or four patents, five patent lawyers. Patent lawyers are a reflection of the amount of activity that's going on in the research and development area. And when you're in the technology business, you better be doing research and development or you're not gonna make it. But research and development doesn't produce profits quarter to quarter. It produces longer-term profits, and it's a cost quarter to quarter. And sometime in the 70s, they shifted over to this very short-term thing. That was one problem. The second problem, I think, is that, and the article pointed this out very well, was that when you start having CEOs who take over when they're 60 or 61 and are there for 3 years, that just isn't good for long-term continuity in the company. They pointed out that Welch has been at GE since, I think, 1981. But the same thing could be said of the leaders of H.J. Heinz or PPG Industries or you name any of the other major corporations in the city here, let alone elsewhere. And you don't see a new CEO every 3 or 4 years. You see somebody getting in there in his late 40s, early 50s, and staying with it, unless there's some problem with it, they get rid of it. And they have 8 or 10 or 12 years in which to make their mark on the company. I was just reading an article about Coca-Cola. And you know, Coca-Cola went from, it's hard to remember it this way, but a struggling company in the early 80s when their immediate past CEO just died, passed away, took over, to a dominant factor in the world, in their industry. It's hard to remember, but Coca-Cola was losing market share both in the U.S. and abroad to Pepsi-Cola. And there was a period when some people thought that Pepsi would eventually pass Coke. And the CEO came in and turned it around, but he had a long sweep of time. Management does count. And I think that Westinghouse, in my judgment, suffered from not really first-rate management at the time. The individuals individually were fine. Mm-hmm. None of them had a long enough tenure and time to really put into effect the things that were needed. If you're only going to be president 3 years, you're going to want to make your mark right now. And I think that was my judgment. The major problem.
Well, thank you for sharing those insights.
I don't know whether you want me to say.
Go ahead.
I guess I should mention that over the years there have been some other clients, apart from Westinghouse, that I've spent a lot of time with. Maybe not directly, although I've done a lot of time. I spent a lot of time for a client called Enamel Products and Plating Company. That's owned by the Brand family. Two parts of the family. There's Ken and Bob, who are brothers, and their cousin Rich were the principals of the company. Rich's sister, Nancy Goldstein, was a part owner. She doesn't live in Pittsburgh. She died recently. The company was founded in St. Louis in the 40s and moved its headquarters to Pittsburgh in the 60s. I met Ken Brand and Bob Brand through Rod of Shalom when they joined the junior congregation. And they eventually became a client of the firm's. And our firm did a lot of work for them, but I was the attorney partner responsible for that account. We had some other clients where I didn't do a lot of work for, but I was responsible for bringing them into the firm and was the, what we call the billing partner. If they had complaints, I was the one who got the complaints. Fortunately, not too often. So over the years, after I became a partner, there were these other clients that we worked with. I worked with Stanley Skirball, who was at one time, he's retired now, but at one time he was in the advertising business, Skirball and Garber, and before that Carlton Advertising. Don Horwitz was one of his partners, and Don, his wife Carol, started Plantscape, and we represented Plantscape for many years. That's the largest woman-owned business in Western Pennsylvania. Carol Horwitz's business. Don is, of course, a major factor in that business, but the business side of that business is really Carol's, with Don providing a lot of very imaginative marketing and other things, advertising, other things related to that. So there have been a number of other clients beyond Westinghouse that I worked with. When I was doing a lot of labor work, I did a lot of work for Bayer. Bayer is a major client of the firm. And at one time, and still today, we do labor work for them. And when I got in the labor department, when I formed the labor crew, they were a client that we did no labor work for, and I sat down with the general counsel of MOBE, which is their principal, one of their principal subsidiaries, and MOBE, general counsel, was an old friend of mine from Westinghouse days. He had been in the general counsel's office at Westinghouse. Had a particular labor problem when we handled that for that week. Started doing a lot of labor work for Bayer. So did that, did labor work for the Meadows at one time. We still do work for the Meadows. My partner Stu Williams is a major outside counsel for them now. So there have been other clients of the firm that I've done work for beyond Westinghouse. Westinghouse, because of the nuclear area, is the area I'm principally associated with. I don't remember if we talked at all about how I got involved in Jewish affairs.
We're going to save that.
We're going to save
that next.
Okay.
For the last session.
That's the last session.
Yes.
All right, how I got re-involved, I should say.
That's right.
I was involved up until I was involved until about 71. And then basically dropped out of Jewish affairs, other than belonging as a member, but not any activity until about 84.
We'll want to know why you dropped out, and then
okay.
And we'll get to that next.
All right.
Great.